The content of this episode may be emotionally challenging, confronting, or disturbing for some listeners. If you need to talk to someone, support is available 24/7. For a full list of support services in Australia, head to servicesaustralia.gov.au or click on the link in the description of this episode. I would also like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land where I work and live. I pay my respects to the elders past, present, and emerging. I recognise their continued connection to the land and waters of this country by celebrating the stories, culture, and traditions of the Indigenous and Torres Strait Islander people, and acknowledge that they never ceded sovereignty. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land. Today's guest is an Indigenous woman I admire so much, and I have had the privilege of being able to form a relationship with this amazing individual over the last couple of years. And so when I asked her if she would be able to find the time just a couple of days before Christmas to record this episode, she was more than happy to make it work. Today's guest is the amazing Ashley Donoghue. She is an author, advocate for domestic and family violence, educator, the CEO of Mudjungal, and one of the loudest and proudest voices for the Indigenous community. Sadly, when we recorded this episode, we were at 99 women being murdered at the hands of men in 2024. And right now, as I'm about to release this episode, we are now at 101 women murdered. Ashley's book, Because I Love Him, is available now, and is a must-read for anyone who wants to understand the intricacies associated with gender-based violence. I am your host, Chantel, and this is Inside the Mind. Thank you so much for doing this. I can't get over what's happening. I can't get over what we found out yesterday with that young girl being hunted down in the street. And I just thought we have to do something because I don't know. I'm lost for words. I'm sure you are too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there anything you won't want to talk about?
No, I talk about most things.
Every interview I see with you, podcast, things like that, you are very open, which is really, really great.
Well, look. I think that's the problem. People are, especially for Aboriginal women, see that there's a huge difference with Aboriginal women and our men as opposed to non-Aboriginal women. You know, and I'm going to be very blatantly blunt here, in the white feminist space, that there's a hatred towards men.
Yeah.
There is. There's it's an obvious hatred. Aboriginal women don't hate their men. Even me, the father, I don't hate that man. I don't hate him. I don't love him. I don't like him. I don't care either way. And I guess that's because when we think of men in this country, you got to remember, and this is the big picture, this is the big issue that's not being told for Aboriginal people. We talk about colonization, right? We talk about our women being raped, the babies being ripped out of their arms. But our men, our four grandfathers, had to stand there and watch that and be helpless. You know, they had to raise babies that weren't theirs and treat them as their own and then have those babies ripped out of their arms. So when you think about that for Aboriginal men, and then in order to be considered a man, a citizen, they had to act like white men. What were those white men doing? Raping, bashing, drinking, smoking, all those things. And then in society today, Aboriginal people are this, that, and everything else. It was taught to them.
Yeah.
It's not rocket science. And so, and our men, and the difference between Aboriginal men and non-Aboriginal men is that the awfuler white men are, for example, bloody Donald Trump, that other bloke that's in jail now, all these, men that are being called out for abusiveness. They get more power. I'm going to go to jail.
Oh, yeah. Could you imagine an Indigenous man doing even 1% of what Donald Trump has done and being the Prime Minister? It would never happen.
Imagine. Look at Stan Grant. He wrote a book about the Queen and, you know, a book, his thoughts on it. And he was brought to his knees as an Aboriginal man. So the imbalance around that is not spoken about enough. And so our men get accused of being the only men that assault Aboriginal women. And I'm not, you know, saying they don't, they do. You know, Aboriginal men do assault Aboriginal women. We know that, but so do a lot of other nationality. And the systemic violence that's perpetrated against our men and women far outweighs anything. There's no need for any proof of that because the juvenile detention centres are full of Aboriginal kids. Aboriginal women make up 41% of incarcerated women in New South Wales. 31% are Aboriginal men. We make up less than 3% of the population combined.
Yeah, it makes no sense.
Yeah, people want proof. You know, they want the truth. They can't handle the truth.
Oh, I love that. We just throw a movie quote in there. But you're absolutely right. And I was thinking about this last night and I was like, the government continuously put money into funding these things about First Nations-led research into family and domestic violence. And it's like, but you already know the answer. Why are you continually putting millions of dollars into something you already know the answer to? Imagine what you could do with that money.
I know what I'd do with that money as the CEO of the only 100% run by and for Aboriginal Women's Centre in metropolitan Sydney.
That gets no money.
I can't say that anymore. They gave us some money this year for 12
months. Oh, for 12 months.
Let's hope that is on. Otherwise, they'll be hearing more from me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it took them long enough. It's been around for, what, 32 years?
Yeah. You know another big discrepancy? Is the national plan, right? There's a national plan to end violence against all women by 2032, I think it is. Is it 2032?
Yeah, it was like a 10-year period, wasn't it? They want to eradicate it in like 10 years.
And they've done another one. There's a separate one for Aboriginal women to reduce violence against Aboriginal women by 50% a year before the end of the actual national plan. Now, I thought maybe the women that were working on that didn't want to set Aboriginal women up to fail, right? But there's nothing in that plan that says that. If that was the opening statement of that plan, imagine how more powerful that would be, right? So in my view, only half of the Aboriginal women are worth saving in this country, yet they're eliminating violence against all women in these deadly plans for every other woman. Like, you know, do they not cross-reference? It boggles my mind sometimes how they write these things. They put all this money in research and then, and you know, another thing, just while I'm on my little high horse, when we then have to write submissions, right, for funding, it's like we're continually bleeding our blood, our trauma, onto these pages for the white gaze. And then if our trauma isn't enough for that white gaze, which was 32 years of trauma being put on these pages where we never got funding, then we don't get funding. You know, like what does it take? And they want us to prove in these submissions what they already know because they're the ones doing the research.
Yeah.
Aboriginal people are the most researched people in the world. They're the ones telling us how bad we've got it, and yet we're going to prove that in submissions. Like, it's ludicrous.
Yeah, like it doesn't match up at all. Like, if this was happening, if you reversed it and made 3% of the population white and this was happening, it's not 50% that we're going to eradicate domestic violence. It would be 100%. And so it's this, and people hate to hear it, but Australia is a racist country. It is so, it's so obvious. They are a racist country. I'm a white person. I'm telling you right now, they are a racist country. We are a racist country, as in Australia. It's disgraceful.
Well, you know, it's the thing with the flags at the moment. They're carrying on about flags. They're carrying on about welcome to country. And I seen a meme the other day, well, if welcome to country has to be eliminated, so does the national anthem, because that's not inclusive.
100%. I have this argument with people all the time. I will stand for the welcome to country. I will stand. I will shut up. I love it. I get emotional hearing it.
Yeah.
And I'm a white person, but I love it so much. The Australian anthem, I don't mean to be an asshole about it, but I don't give a fuck, if I'm honest, because it's not inclusive. It's just not. And I don't again, it feels like a distraction, right? I feel like they throw these things in as a distraction. Peter Dutton, I don't want to stand in front of the Indigenous flag.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, I don't want you to stand in front of any flag. Like, fuck off.
Yeah. I don't want you to stand. Yeah.
Are we allowed to say that? Yes, we are. We are allowed to say that. I don't know. Well, I mean, you know, men say whatever they want. Why can't we?
That's right.
You know?
You know, in this country, this is what baffles me, 99 women murdered. And the year's not over yet. And at this rate, we're going to go over 100.
It's scary.
And the most that the government can do is chuck money at organisations, right? But my belief is unless it's – this needs to be a structural change and it has to come from the top down. They're expecting like a bottom-up approach for domestic violence. And that's not going to work because domestic violence doesn't discriminate.
No. And that's never worked, right?
No, it's never worked.
That approach has never worked anywhere in any country.
No.
For any issue at all, though. Like, why would they think that it would work for this one? But your 99 right. is just, when we talked about doing this podcast only a couple of weeks ago, we were at 87.
Yeah, and we thought that was extreme, but now it's
I couldn't believe that number, and now for 99, and I just wonder what the real number is. Like, I wonder if there's probably a lot more there that we just don't know about at this point.
Exactly.
And it's scary.
The only reason you do know is because of social media.
Because of the Red Heart campaign.
That's right. And because no one's doing a count on the news. Like, you don't hear that these numbers on the news.
Yeah.
Or you only hear particular ones. So unless social media was doing this work, like the, you know, Red Heart, like there's a few on there that are doing this work.
There is.
Including yourself, like letting people know what's happening.
Yeah.
Who would know?
No. And that's the scary thing, right? Who would know? Like, you turn on the news and you may see something about a woman being murdered. But you very rarely, if at all, see a First Nation woman's murder leaving the news. I'm wondering, do you think that racism is the main reason for that? Like, why is it so hard for First Nations people, or women in particular, to be seen, to be heard, for people to, like, they're affected more than anyone.
A racism absolutely plays a part too. And, you know, the first response, you know, especially in country towns, like where the police aren't there 7 days a week, like if they've got a, you know, sometimes they're in one town for 3 nights and the other, and there's one way in and one way out. And if the perpetrator knows that the police are coming from one way, they'll go the other way. You know what I mean? But the response for Aboriginal women is ridiculous. And a lot of that's because, you know, especially if they've been called a few times, they're going to go back and they're going to do this and they're going to do that. Well, that's right. They may, because I always, when you're working in this space, you've got to remember that when we're working with victims of domestic violence, there's a 50-50 chance they'll go back, right? There's a 50-50 chance they'll leave. And whichever way they go, that's not for us to judge. We're just there when they call out again. And that's the approach the police need to have. They can't be judging. Because there's many reasons women go back, regardless of race. And so that's one of the biggest things. And there needs to be an alternative to policing in domestic violence. Like, I'm all for the police to be called in domestic violence because they do need to be called, right? But but I'm not in support of having women interviewed immediately. As a survivor of extreme domestic violence, the last thing you want to do is give an interview because your adrenaline's pumping, you know, you're worrying about your kids, blood's dripping out of your head or whatever. Like, so the last thing you can do is be asked these questions over and over and over and over again. So there needs to be a space to take women that have been affected by domestic violence to just have a minute.
Yeah.
Just have a minute.
Yeah.
Gather themselves to make sure their kids are safe because any woman that's been through a DV, if you say, what do you want? She'll say, I just want to be safe.
Yeah, not interrogated and not re-victimized again, which is how it feels. It is. It's
judged, discriminated against, all the things.
Yeah. It's always put back on the woman.
Yeah.
And I heard you say earlier in the year in an interview, I think it was Living Black, an episode that you did.
Yeah.
And you were talking about what if we change the way that we actually word this, right? Instead of one woman's being murdered every 4 days, how about one man's killing a woman every 4 days?
Yeah.
Like, why don't we flip it instead of making it a women's issue? Because it's not a women's issue.
Right.
It's a man's issue.
Domestic violence is all about men.
100%.
Men are killing men. Even men are scared of men.
Yeah.
You know, I shared a meme this morning that, you know, society uses men who drink alcohol, that's a man's excuse to be drunk. But for women, that's the reason that they, you know, that they're blamed. Oh, well, you were drunk. That's what that happened to you because of that. You know, like double standard in society in general worldwide is pathetic. And that, again, is a top-down approach. And until we fix up the powers that be, nothing's going to change. Because the reality is, like, you could have the best police officers, right? You could do the woman, and this has been proven, the woman can do all the things right. But if it gets to court and that judge is judgmental against women and maybe a perpetrator himself, which, you know, isn't unheard of.
Happened.
It doesn't matter what evidence is there, he gets the last say. So unless the judges and whatnot are skilled up, and I understand that they can only judge on the evidence that's given, but a lot of the time the evidence that's given is dismissed in DV cases in favour of men. Especially if the man's a white man and the victim's an Aboriginal woman, like she's already taking steps back.
Yeah,
you know, so it has to change there. Our prime minister needs to do something. There needs to be the same effect around domestic violence as there was for COVID and the coward punch.
100%.
They could do that. They could do that for women.
Yeah, it blows my mind that they haven't done that yet. Like every year, we're seeing a rise in the amount of women that are being murdered by men. And yet I'm hearing a lot of silence at the moment, and the silence is deafening, and it's making me think even more what I already thought, which was they don't give a fuck about women, and they definitely do not care about First Nations women at all. It's even worse, and it's disgraceful and it's disgusting. And I don't know how the Prime Minister can sit there and see this number of 99 women. We've got another week left in the year and nothing.
Yeah.
Like, you're not going to say anything. No. And you come out earlier in the year and you give this speech, whatever, oh, it's a national crisis. We're going to give $5,000 as a one-off payment. What is $5,000 going to do?
I dressed something about that too. Oh. If you've got five kids, it's nothing. Like, you know, that's a plane fare to Brisbane.
Yeah, like you're going to end up going back, because I think people don't understand completely that domestic violence is more than just being hit. It's the financial abuse, right? So what's five grand going to do? Great, gets you out for a little bit, and then you're going to be straight back there, because how are you going to support your family?
That's right.
So it's,
that's not even a month in this country.
No, well,
with food and electricity and whatnot.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I was sitting down and looking at my own bills and going, okay, what could I do with $5,000? And I was like, and I've got no children and it's just me. And I'm like, how anyone with children who's going through this amount of trauma and that can keep themselves safe and their children safe and fed and everything, I just can't see how that's going to happen. And
that's the point of throwing money, thinking that money is the source of eliminating violence, and it's not.
Yeah.
It's fund the right organisations to do the work on the ground, absolutely.
Yeah.
But little bits of like that are helpful for a week, and then what?
Yeah.
See, I think there's two things that need to happen. The ankle bracelet, when an AVO is put in place, so should an ankle bracelet. An AVO isn't a criminal offence, nor is an ankle bracelet. And with that comes a team in the police. Like, they rave on about wasting all this money. Put that money in a team for DV. So as soon as there's an alert on a bracelet, the police are there within 15 minutes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Imagine how many assaults would be prevented and deaths would be prevented. Because they're saying, yeah, ankle bracelets on high risk. How do you know who's high risk?
It's a fair point.
You know? Because if an AVO is put on a man, that's high risk.
Yeah.
There doesn't have to be four times breach before it's high risk. Or they've already gone to jail for a crime and it's high risk. If there's an AVO put in place, there's a risk of that man murdering that woman. Because if a man puts his hand on a woman, it's the intent to harm, maim, or kill.
Yeah.
So that's high risk enough for me.
Yeah, I agree. 100%. Like, if they're going to do that, and we've seen it a lot with men that are killing women, they have a history. It's not like they've just woken up that day and they're just like, I'm just going to kill this woman. There's usually a history there. There's usually signs leading up to it, and yet nothing's done in the lead up to it.
That's right. But the thing is that women that are in domestic violence relationships don't wake up every morning and, oh, I got bashed up again last night.
Of course not.
That's not something, because that shame, because we carry the shame, and that shame's got to be, you know, that's got to be put back onto the perpetrators, because they're the ones doing, that's shameful for them. So that's what that bracelet will do. Embarrass them, put that shame back on them.
Yeah.
Let them walk around with a bright pink bracelet around their ankle or whatever colour, you know, to let people know, oh, he's a perpetrator of DV. Put that shame back on them and watch a change there. You know, there's got to be, I forget what I was going to say about the second thing, but that's one of the main things that I've been advocating for, is if there's an AVO put in place, there's an ankle bracelet put in place, there's a unit so that, you know, and if police don't respond in an appropriate time, there's consequences for them too.
Well,
that's one of the things.
Yeah, I agree. Because they're clearly not equipped, right? I'd say that there's a problem with police in this country, especially when it comes to this. They're not equipped. And
they're not trained properly in it too. Or they're not. You know, in support of them, they don't get enough training in DV. And you've got young 21-year-old men becoming police officers holding guns, who've probably never interacted with Aboriginal people. I'm speaking as an Aboriginal woman here. And they, all of a sudden, they're called out to a domestic violence incident for Aboriginal people, and they wouldn't know what, if their left or right works. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They wouldn't know what they're doing, to be honest, because the training isn't adequate. I reckon that for these DV units, there has to be some qualification so that they're really aware of what domestic violence looks like in all its forms. And, you know, there needs to be, in my opinion, a national definition and a national consequence. So it doesn't matter where you go in Australia, domestic violence is the same. So that takes away the confusion.
Yeah.
And if you're a perpetrator of domestic violence, it's a crime, and it doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, how big your wallet is, what shoes you wear, the consequences will be the same Australia-wide.
Yeah.
It has to be a blanket approach in order for it to stop, because so many big, rich people are getting away with it. And the jails are getting full of the not-so-rich people who don't get away with it. No one should be getting away with it.
Yeah, I agree. Would you like to – I was reading an article where someone was talking about how they'd like domestic violence to almost fall under that kind of subheading of terrorism. Would you like it to be classified as terrorism? I think it should be. It is a form of terrorism.
Attacked in the street and shot. What would you call that?
I just, 23-year-old, hunted. 23-year-old woman hunted by two men. I know we're still, like, learning the details of it, and shot and murdered, executed.
Yeah.
That,
you know, women put in acid baths. What would you call that?
Yeah.
You know, women just being killed, wrapped up and dumped in a plastic bag. What would you call that?
Yeah.
Put in buckets and barrels. What are we calling that?
Yeah.
Killed in front of their children. That's terrorism.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like the government do these things where they try to, it's like the illusion that they're doing something, but really it's a band-aid for a really deep wound.
Oh, look, I bet you any money, I bet you anything, in the next month or so there'll be one of those other beatdowns on DV perpetrators. Police knocking on doors, or there'll be something in the news to take away from if we reach 100 women, you watch something come up that's going to shut that down.
Yeah.
You can guarantee it. Because that's another thing that needs to be modified and police, for want of a better word, the media and how they report on women. And especially when they're talking about people, you know, the Aboriginal woman that was found on the dirt road.
Yeah.
Talking about things like that before the family even knows what's going on. Like, you know, and that's any family. Like, you know, families don't want to see their loved ones on TV or even social media. People need to be mindful of what they share. Like, I always wait until I see that if anything's shared, that it's been shared on the news or the family said something. like before I so that's why I'm always a little bit behind in the thing, because I want to make sure that I'm not making it worse for anybody else.
That's actually a very good, yeah, valid point there, to not just be putting out all these photos of these people, because that is very traumatizing for the family.
Family
and for me personally, I had a good friend of mine who was murdered by her partner in 2013, and it was front of the paper all over the, like, it was so confronting. And the funeral was confronting because there were, like, the media was there and there were police. Like, it was just so confronting to see that myself and her family and friends, we hated that. I can't imagine you doing that on an even bigger scale as well, and if you're a First Nations person, the harm that would cause.
Yeah, but the media and their wording, like, it's always victim-blaming. Even the police are victim-blaming. In the last two murders, they more or less blamed the woman. She got herself killed. No, she did not. She was killed at the hands of men. Some of those men proclaiming to love her.
Yeah.
You know? And it's pathetic. Like, don't get the police talking if they're going to victim blame, because that doesn't make them look good in these bad situations. It doesn't make anyone look good.
No, it was a horrible thing to say when he said that. I was like, did I hear that right? Like, I thought, oh, no, I must have misheard that then. It shocked me that how could you get up there and say that? I don't think you could ever blame a victim for their death. There's no reason. Like, what's the reason? Can we talk about your experience with it a little bit?
Yeah.
Because I read your book, Because I Love Him, earlier in the year. And, I mean, I don't want to say it was a beautifully written book or like a great book, because it's a heart-wrenching book. But you know what I'm getting?
Yeah, it's a hard book, but it's easy read.
It is. And
like,
and I felt like I did have moments. There were days and weeks of time where I had to put it down because I did find it a little bit triggering from my own personal story, which is completely different to yours. Mine's more in childhood abuse from parents and partners, but also I've been in an abusive same-sex relationship, which is different again. But, like, there are things in there where you go, oh, wow, that's my story and I'm not alone in this. Was that, like, the intention behind, or one of the intentions behind writing this book, is to show women that no matter what walk of life you are, we all kind of have this thing in common?
That was absolutely the main thing, because I've started talking to women, all women and men, you know, about domestic violence, and I could see my story in so many, like, you know, and I thought, my story, like, you may not resonate with all my story, but there'll be little bits in there, because I had so many different wives, you know. I was all, you know, I was a drug addict's wife, I was an alcoholic's wife, I was a jail wife, I was a, you know, a battered wife. I was all the wives except a legal wife. So
that's a very good point, actually. Yeah, you were never a legal wife, were you? No.
So I knew that, you know, it might not be everything, and even my childhood, like, you know, not everyone could resonate with that, but there'd be bits in that did. And you know, and then just coming into my own, that too would resonate with people. Maybe not in the way I did it, but in different ways, like, you know. And my whole thing for writing the book was to let women know, specifically women, that you're never too old to be great, and that, you know, you can find a way out, but you have to do it safely. And any woman that's left and not gone back, and it takes many times, as in my book, once you've made your mind up, you'll know that you've made your mind up.
Yeah.
Because I used to think, oh, I knew that wasn't the end. I knew, but when I did, I knew that, no, that's it, I'm done. And it could be the simplest thing. You know, like, people always think that there's this big thing. That's another thing. We, as women, or anyone that's in DV relationships, you don't need an excuse. So many women will wait until, oh, I can't wait for him to bash me so I can leave, or I can't wait for him to do this or do that so I can leave. And when that happens, these men feel that your anxiety, they feel your stress. So they think, she's about to leave. And then what happens? A lot of women are murdered.
Yeah.
Because we as women feel like we need an excuse. We don't need an excuse. If you've thought, fuck this, I'm going, I've had enough, then go, sis, go.
Yeah.
Don't wait for him to hit you. Don't wait for him to take all your money. Don't wait for him to assault your kids or you, your mother, your dog, your whatever, smash up your house.
Yeah.
If once you've thought, had that thought, just do it. Act, just go. Because that way he's not going to know that you're all G'd up and ready to escape. And sometimes that means that you've got to leave everything behind. And that's what a lot of Aboriginal women, when they leave with their baby on their hip and their clothes on their back.
Yeah, that's so true. What do you think about when people say, and I hate when people say this, but when they say, well, why didn't she just leave?
That's not as easy as it seems. And if it was.
Oh, it would happen.
It would happen.
Yeah.
But the reality with that is that a lot of women do leave, but they go back.
That's true.
And that's what I mean. It's a thing. A lot of women do leave. But a lot of women, and I say this over and over, a lot of women who, where sometimes the abuse is three times a year, they'll think, oh, well, you know, that all the other good outweighs that so-and-so, blah, blah. And so they don't want the relationship then. They just want the violence to stop.
Yeah. How long were you with your ex-partner? It was over 14 years, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of the appropriate way to...
Just say it.
How many times did you leave? Like, did you leave? Because there was obviously a lot of things happening and he was living here and you were there and then you'd move and this and that. But
yeah, see, he was living... The majority of the time he was living with me and my family.
Yeah.
So I had the upper hand to kick him out. But I just... I was addicted to him.
Yeah. You say that in the book and it feels like that, right? Like it does. And that's really common. It is really common. Like people judge it, but unless you've been in it, you don't really understand.
It's like any drug. You know it's bad for you, but you still want it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it really is. It's the best way to explain it, really.
Yeah. And in DV, especially when it's so high volatile, another thing that's not spoken about is that the physical attraction. Because once you sleep with that man, in their head everything's back to normal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And a lot and you know, if you've just been assaulted and then he wants to sleep with you, women will sleep with them, not because they want to, but to keep themselves safe and to stop the violence in that very instant. But then if you've had an incident and you kicked him out and let him go, like, and I'm talking from my experience here, I would then worry, oh, what's he doing? Where, you know, and my body would ache for this man.
Yeah.
And that's the addiction part. That's the addiction part. No one talks about that enough. So it's all just like coercive control, right? All that emotional, all that stuff. That's the same thing that makes you go back, is because then you start feeling, oh, what's he doing? What if he gets with someone else? What if he leaves? You know, all these things go through you, because in DV, not all the time, but a lot of the time, you've had kids to this man.
Yeah.
A lot of women, some women do have children to be single mums, but a lot of women in DV, like, you don't have children to these men to end up as a single mother.
No.
Yeah. You know, and one of my biggest reasonings for staying is because I never knew my father. So my kids were going to know their father right or wrong, to my own detriment and to the detriment of my children in the long run. Because when you're in these relationships, you can't see past the end of your own nose. You have no idea of the effects that you're having on your children. And there's this belief system that, oh, because they're not seeing it, it's not happening, like they don't know what's going on. But kids don't have to see the violence. They can they can feel the energy from the mothers, they can, and fathers, they can feel the tension, they can see the bruises. So that affects children too. They can hear it. It's just like if you're living next door to somebody who's getting bashed and you can hear that in your house and that's affecting you, your kids can hear it too, and it's affecting them. So when people don't do anything to help or to do something about the violence that's going next door, they're in turn damaging their children, because then that becomes to them, oh, well, if that happens to me, nobody does anything anyway, so what's the point?
Yeah, that's true.
You get what I mean? So then the people will go up and say, oh, you didn't see me get bashed, you didn't see this and that, but maybe they heard it. Maybe they seen their aunties get bashed. Maybe they seen somebody else get assaulted and abused and whatnot and coercive controlled in the family, yeah. And nobody did anything. So what does that do? It normalizes it.
Yeah, it does.
But I mean that violence is everyone's business. It's not just the two that's but domestic violence is perpetrated mainly by men against women and men. And so therefore men have to be at the table or join in. And I'm sick of all these, what about men? What about men? All these men saying, what about men? Why aren't you doing something?
It's like the not all men phrase, right? Like not all men. Okay, well, I'm now at the point where if you're silent during what is happening right now during this epidemic, you are a part of the problem. Not saying you're an abuser. I'm just saying you are a part of the problem. Like you've got the power here to do something. So do something.
Yeah. We need a leader in the men's space to take it on. We need someone, because right now it's like men are all bystanders. Like I know a lot of men that talk about, oh, we want to do something, but because of all the hatred that's being dished at men, you know, and deservingly too in some respects. But if anyone, it's like a flip side of that thing. If we're going to continually just down on men, then they're not going to rise up and do anything. It's just like the same, you know, unless there's a leader that's going to say, okay, you fellas, let's get together. These are our mothers. These are our daughters. These are our granddaughters, our partners, our sisters, our nieces, whatever. Let's come together and take a stand in this space, because the women can't do it on their own. Because there's no point just educating women about domestic violence if men and boys aren't being educated too.
Well, they're the perpetrators, so they probably need to be educated more, right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's another thing. You know, these men were somebody's baby, right? They were, look, you know, you do it now when they do the gender reveals. Oh, it's a boy, blah, blah, blah. You know, they were somebody's little baby. Where in that lifeline did these little boys learn that it was okay be so mean to girls and women? Where in that, you know?
Yeah.
I'm gonna say 0 to 14, because there's 14-year-old boys being violent to 13-year-old girls.
Yeah.
Where in those first 14 years of life are these boys or children taught that behavior's okay? Because wherever that sits is where it's gotta change. And a lot of it happens at home, because kids don't know that anything is different until they go to school.
Yeah.
And they see different around.
That's true. When you're in that environment, you think this is just what it is for everyone.
And, you know, I was talking to a Indian man, and he said that when he started school, they said, okay, it's your turn to set the table. And he was thinking, well, what does that mean? Because they eat with their hand.
Of course.
You know, so he didn't know that the fork, knife, and what am I going to do with that?
Yeah.
So that's what I mean. People don't know that things are different until they go to school.
That's a good point. Do you think that we should be teaching this type of stuff in school, right? Respect.
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like from an early age, there needs to be age-appropriate stuff taught and continually taught throughout.
All the way through. It can't be just, you know, one term of sex ed. It can't. Because that's not working. It hasn't worked. It's not working.
No.
But you know, our teachers don't get paid enough. There's no respect for teachers nowadays. So the whole education system has to be overturned too. Like, that's what I mean. It's a system. It's a top-down approach.
Yeah. Well, the systemic racism. Everything is built on the back of white supremacy. So, of course, every system is just failing across the board.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is just a really big issue. And, yeah.
And until they admit that, and they want truth telling, until they tell themselves the truth, and they know
Yeah.
It's just like perpetrators. They know if they're a perpetrator of violence or coercive. They men know, women know. You know if you're doing the wrong thing, you know. So this government and the powers that be, they know that what they're doing isn't working and it's not right.
Yeah.
But they're just, their egos are so big that they can't admit that it's not working. And so, therefore, they're just waiting for the next election and then they can just chuck it over to the next person.
Yeah.
So it's just like a toxic system that's continually going every 3 years when the leadership changes.
That's what it feels like because that's what it is. Yeah.
That's all it is.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
With your experience in particular and having children, did your children witness more than you originally thought? Like, have you found out later on that they actually did see or hear more things than you realised at the time?
Yeah. Particularly my son, my daughter did. My daughter says that she had no idea what was going on because, you know, he was never one to be abusive in the house.
Okay.
He was public, making me look like, you know, put me on show type thing.
Yeah.
Except my son, the worst assault, my son seen me covered in blood and I didn't know that he seen that until he was 18 years old. So from four years old, so for 14 years, that little boy, he carried that before he said a word about it. So that broke my heart.
Yeah.
And then me having to take responsibility for my part in that was probably the hardest life lesson I've ever had because we have to take responsibility because, you know, it's all good to say that, I this is my belief only because we're allowing ourselves to be treated so badly. You know, that we are, we do, and our children to be treated so badly. And that is because of fear, like we're fearful. And a lot of it is because of, I'm just going to say it, that selfishness. I was selfish because I wanted that man more than anything. I wanted him to be the father to my children that I wanted for me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's that inner child work that you have to go through. And that's really hard work for women who have been abused to go through in any shape or form. Now, it's a hard one. But if we're as women as victims are going to have these conversations, then we have to speak honestly too of what our feelings are and what makes us in really what makes us stay. We can save fear, we can save money, we can say all these things, and they're all aspects of it too. But when you, like I said, when you've made your mind up to leave, then nothing will stop you. You'll do it. And unfortunately, a lot, you know, not a lot of the time, but some of the time, women are murdered when they do that. But again, that's because I reckon these men know that they're leaving. So that's what I mean. When you're going to leave, you just got to do it. But when he threw that shoe at me, I knew there and that's it. I'm done.
People probably hear that and go, okay, he threw a shoe at you, but he did a lot more than that. What was it about that moment that you went, I'm done here?
Because as a child, my mother used to throw shoes at me. And I believe, it's my belief, I read a quote somewhere, I don't know if I read it or I dreamed it or what, and it says that we, people in general, will tolerate as much abuse in their adulthood as they did in their childhood. And so whatever the trigger for that childhood abuse is the thing that's going to turn the abuse off. And mine was having a shoe thrown at me.
Yeah.
And I've heard lots of women say, oh, as soon as he breaks a bone, that's it. As soon as he breaks one of my bones, I'm going. Or as soon as he does this, I'm going. Or if he does this, that's it. So we've all got a limit. But women that have been abused horrendously as children, when there's no real limit, they're the women that generally stay and stay and stay until they're old and the physical abuse then turns to more mental and emotional where they're having to look after these men that have just been absolute creeps to them all their life. You know, it's so complex. And every woman's different. Every woman's different. But.
And this is why we're talking about, like, not being judgmental and not victim blaming, because it is so complex. And it is so different for everyone. And yes, there might be similarities, but there's a lot that goes into it.
That's what I mean. I don't talk on anything that I haven't been through. I don't talk on being incarcerated because I've never been incarcerated. but my son has, and I was a jail wife. My mother was the Aboriginal welfare officer at Silverwater Prison. My sister was a corrections officer. So I have all that knowledge, you know, from my lived experience, but I would not know what it's like to be in prison. I've never taken drugs. I don't know what it's like to be influenced by drugs. My partner, the father of my kids, turned to heavy drugs. I know what it's like to watch someone withdraw. I know what it's like to be checking clothes. I know what it's like to be worried that he's going to rob you. I know what that feels like. So I only talk on the things that I've experienced, and I stay in my lane.
And do you think that's something that people should really be focused on, is staying in their lane?
I think because, you know, there's lots of people that do research, and there's lots of people that read books, and there's lots of people that think they know. But until you've, it's like anything, until you've been in jail, you don't know what that feels like. So until you've been bashed by a man that you love, and you do love him, and people say, well, it's not love, but when you're in it, it's love. I don't know what that feels like. Until you've got an 18-year-old son telling someone, I remember seeing mum covered in blood, you don't know what that feels like to have your child affected by choices that you made. Like, yeah, I didn't make the choice to be assaulted, but I made the choice to go back.
Yeah. Is there a sense of guilt that comes with that?
The guilt eats you to pieces. The guilt is, I still sometimes have moments of guilt. Even now, after all these years, if I'm triggered in something or I remember something, I just think, what the fuck was I thinking? What, you know? And people say, do you have regrets? And they say, I don't have regrets. I do have regrets. I regret not leaving the very first time, but then I think, oh, but then I wouldn't have my daughter. So then I think, oh, well, if I would have left after I had her. You know what I mean? So there's all these, it's so complex. That's never ever brought into the conversation. Everyone says it's complex. Yeah, it's complex, but it's complex, like I just mentioned. Like you say,
because of these reasons. All those things. Yeah. Yeah, people try and simplify.
Yeah.
And it's really not something that can be simplified. Like this is not a simple issue.
Addiction isn't simple in any shape, way, or form. It's not.
I think it's really important that people hear that this is an addiction. It is like an addiction. Of course it is.
Yeah, that's my belief anyway.
I hear the government promise a lot of things, and we're not really seeing much of what they're promising, but they do promise a lot of things. What they put together this panel earlier in the year, and I was looking at who was on it, and I saw there's a lot of white people on there. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of white people on there, which I don't have an issue with there being white people. I'm wondering where the Indigenous people are, where the Indigenous women are at this table, and I'm confused as to, for someone like you, for example, like I would have thought you would have been the first call that the government would have made, because you've got lived experience, professional experience. So shouldn't you be at this table?
Well, I reckon I should be, because in that see things in a totally different light. The thing is that you've got people around the table that have been around the table for a long time. They're talking to the same.
Yeah, nothing's happening.
Nothing's happening. Because what people don't see is what, when you work in a place like Mudjingal, people are saying that they advocate for Aboriginal women, they do all this for Aboriginal women, but they're not seeing exactly what Aboriginal women are going through. Whereas at this organisation, you see it. You see it firsthand. You see the women coming through our doors before they go to the police. Some women don't even want to go to the police. You know, so you're seeing the whole complexities of what's going on and whatnot. And, you know, a lot of the people that were sitting around that table say they advocate for Aboriginal people. If that were the case, they should have said, you know what, I'm going to give up my seat and I'm going to give it to this person, or I'm going to give it to this Aboriginal woman who I know is in here doing the work. And every single person around that table knows an Aboriginal woman that's doing the work.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a lot of it's ego-driven. You know, a lot of it's, you know, it's their career. Whereas for Aboriginal women, it's their life.
And this is the thing that just doesn't match up for me. It's like, yeah, you're right. It's a career thing, an ego thing. But we're talking about people's lives here. We're talking about their families. We're talking, like, who cares about your career? Like, we're actually talking about a human being.
Yeah.
who could be sitting at that table.
It's the next paper. It's the next research question. It's their next, you know, policy. And how yeah. many how many big research money goes into research and just sits on a shelf?
Yeah, nothing's changed though.
It's changing.
So we've done all this research, millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars we've spent on research. Nothing's changed. The number's getting higher every year.
It's like the coercive control legislation. There's absolutely no difference between the definition of coercive control and domestic violence. There's no difference. There's not a difference. And yet all that money went into changing something that's already in ABOs, was in every single ABO regardless of state. It's got to not coerce in it.
Yeah.
So it's mind-boggling.
Like, why? I just don't understand why they're wasting money on these things. Like, who's advising these people?
If they're going to change a definition, do a, like I said, a national definition of what domestic and family violence is.
Yeah.
And that, and stick to that.
Is that what you would like to see?
That's what I would like to see. It's got to happen. Because otherwise, because...
It needs its own. It does need its own. You're absolutely right.
It does. Because getting bashed in the Northern Territory is no difference to getting bashed in Tasmania.
No. Well, yeah, what's the difference? You know what the difference is? Well, the difference is racism.
Oh, yeah, well, racism's Australia-wide. Yeah. More so up north. But, you know, but that's what I mean. So we've got to take that out of the equation and call it what it is. It's assault. It's a crime. Yeah. So, therefore, the crime should be fitting nationwide.
Yeah. It's like when you're talking about the coward punch and, you know, you can get 20 years and this and that. What I didn't know is that it has to be a stranger. Like if you coward punch your partner in the house, it's not a coward punch.
Not a coward punch. And they have to be under the influence of alcohol and drugs.
What the hell is that? That I thought a coward punch was legit if I just walked up to someone and committed a coward punch. Like I didn't realise that there was all these things. And I think there will be a lot of people listening to this going, really? Like I didn't know that. That to me is baffling that, yeah, there's all these like little things. So if you're not under the influence and you coward punch someone, but it's not actually a coward punch.
You go home. Yeah, you go home and you punch your wife in the face, she falls, dies, nothing. It's a domestic violence offence. And that's another thing. In domestic violence, they get charged with grievous bodily harm. 2 years you get for grievous bodily harm.
Isn't that just like I actually don't know what to say to that. Like 2 years. 2 years.
Yeah. And if there's other crimes with it, it can run concurrent, which means it'll all just be packaged into the 2 years.
Would you like to see a minimum sentence be handed down?
It's got
to
be.
5 years, let's say that's the minimum, but then it can go up?
If you get AVO and you get the ankle bracelet, you breach that AVO, you're straight in. Off you go, 2 years.
Yeah, like there's no, and it's the whole 2 years.
Oh, yeah. You put your hand, if there's an assault, off you go 5 years. You come out and breach it again, you're back in for 5 years.
Yeah.
We ought to prison for DV perpetrators. I don't care. But, you know, everyone's saying, oh, prison doesn't work. I know for a fact that if the father of my kids wouldn't have went to jail, I would have been dead.
Yeah.
So you know, we've got, it's, you know, and I know that there's some areas where, you know, prison isn't the answer, but there's got to be a consequence for the murdering and bashing of women in this country. And right now there isn't any. Can't put that onto the community to fix because it's not a community problem.
Yeah, no, I don't know how the community are going to fix it.
They won't be able to fix it.
Hasn't happened yet. Like, you know, yeah, you're right.
And how rarely do you hear of a coward punch incident? There was one a month or so ago. That got national coverage again.
Yeah, it did.
But that's one. Yeah. You know, and yet we've got 99 women murdered. See, consequences make changes.
Why do you think there are no consequences? What is the hold-up here when the government could just, like, do something?
Because the majority of men in power are probably perpetrators, and so therefore they're sticking up for their own.
Yeah,
it's patriarchy. It's, you know, I'm Lee Tarzan, you Jane mentality.
It's just, yeah, it's so frustrating.
One other little thing I just want to bring to the attention is that with refuges, that needs to change too, because if you've got twins, right, one's a boy, one's a girl, they're 14 years old, the 14-year-old boy can't go to the refuge. So what are we teaching our boys? See, my thing is, what are we teaching these boys? That you're not worthy of protection. You can go back and dad can beat you again. You know what I mean? or you could just sleep on the street. That mum's going to leave their 14-year-old son. But that means that women that have got sons aren't going to leave.
Why is that a thing? Why can't they go in there?
Because there's this thing of 14-year-old boys, you know, that's almost potential perpetrators, which isn't healthy for young boys anyway.
Yes, you're labelling people that from the start, that seems extremely dangerous.
It does, and we've got, and that's what I mean. What are we teaching these boys? That's, we're teaching the boys there with that one legislation is that they don't matter, that they're not worth protecting, they're not worth keeping safe. So what do you think that 14-year-old boy is going to think? Well, no one cares about me. Nobody loves
me. And then they go back home, for example, and maybe are getting beaten and they're witnessing it.
And it starts
the cycle again.
That's it again.
Do you think that someone who is abusive can change?
I think people that are abusive know that they're abusive. And so when somebody knows that there's something, there's always room for change.
Yeah.
You know, if you acknowledge that what you're doing is wrong, if you acknowledge that, okay, these are my triggers, then you can change. But if people are just assaulting women really quickly for no reason other than to control them and treat them, you know, some people can change, some people can't. Like, it depends. It really depends. But I mean, everyone deserves a chance of sorting themselves out. You know what I mean? There's got to be, and if there's no opportunity, like men's programs and things to help men identify what their triggers are, why they do this. No one's asking, like I said, what made men like this. So where's the healing for them?
It's a great point.
You know?
It's a great point. Yeah, but it doesn't get mentioned,
and there's not, and so, you know, because I know when I done the tackling violence program, I had men lining up and saying, "Oh, but I take care of all the money. Does that make me this? Does that make me that?" Because men don't know what they don't know either.
That's true. Yeah, well, I mean, look at the way society, like we just talked about the patriarch, like the way society has been set up, this type of thing. Yeah. But I think it's also really important. I don't know if this is. Please correct me if this is the wrong thing to say. But just because maybe someone can change doesn't mean you have to stay in that relationship.
That's right. That's right. You don't. That's right. Like I said, you do not need an excuse. And the biggest thing that women need to realize, or anyone in a relationship, you can't change anyone. People are going to do whatever they want to do anyway. They're going to do it anyway, regardless.
Yeah.
But the thing is that when women do leave these toxic, abusive relationships, those men get in with other women really quickly, and then they continue. So there's men that are just that think that that's how you do it, that's how you treat it. So we've got to change that mentality. And again, that starts at a young age.
It does. Do you think that your ex-partner? Do you know much about his home life and growing up? Did he grow up with that being?
I knew enough to know that he'd witnessed some really you know, not so nice things growing up. I was so young and I was very naive and I just thought, oh, my God, look, this beautiful man. I'm going to have babies to him.
And you did. You did have babies to him.
I did. Watch your intentions.
You're right. Were there signs early on?
Yeah, straight away. But I didn't know them. See,
and this is the other thing. This is what we need to be teaching children. These are the signs because they are very different. There's a lot of different signs.
And see, when he hit me the first time, I hit him back. So I thought that was like fair go. And it's never a fair go, you know, just how I was raised. But the thing is that I had a same-sex friend. She said to me, she goes, that's what happens in same-sex relationships is when you're with two women and one woman's the perpetrator, one woman's the victim, the police and society said, oh, well, it's a fair go because it's two women. And she said, but it's not a fair go either. Because that's that power and control, the different, you know. Yeah. Think about everyone in a relationship has that equal standing. And it's when you're in those relationships, it's not equal standing.
No.
And that's what we have to approach too.
Yeah. How do you want to end this right now? What do you want to say to people?
I just
go for it.
I just want particularly women is to know that nothing about violence is love. You know? People say, oh, love hurts. Love doesn't hurt. Love is supposed to heal and feel warm and fuzzy. People that hurt you are people that don't know how to love properly because of things that have happened to them. You know, loving someone isn't like giving them a punch in the mouth or, you know, taking all their money or controlling what they wear or who they talk to. So love is a very powerful, beautiful thing. It's not ugly and shameful and guilt-ridden, which is what domestic violence relationships are. There's nothing pretty about DV. There's nothing pretty about violence. Love has nothing to do with violence. And so we need to understand that. Because a lot of women think, oh, he loves me. If he puts his hand on you, he doesn't love you. Very few women leave after the first hit. But very few women, before that first hit, there's always verbal abuse or controlling manners. No one just, you know, I won't say no one because I know people that have just been hit. But there's generally some form of abuse before, name calling, you know, being called out of your name or all these awful words that are thrown around these days before violence. But that is violent too. And that's what I mean. Nothing about violence is love.
I think it's really important that people really do understand that domestic violence is so much more than just someone hitting you. Yeah. It's so much more. It's financial control. It's control over who you're seeing, what you're wearing, name.
And we all deserve to be loved properly.
Yeah.
You know, the way we are.
Yeah.
But we have to, but the thing is that we sometimes settle. Don't settle. Don't settle, pedal. Don't do it. Don't settle.
Has it made you, I know I wasn't going to ask any more questions, but this made me think of something. Has it made you, you don't have to answer this. I don't know if you're in a relationship or not, but has it made you be like, no, like, I don't want to be in a relationship?
Oh, maybe like that. It made me like that for many years. I was just thinking, not doing that again.
Is it because you thought the same thing would happen or?
Because I was scared that I'd allow myself to be treated badly again because I hadn't healed properly. And that's another thing. We have to heal.
Okay.
You have to heal. You have to come to terms with your, like I said earlier, like, you know, your part in it, like, you know, be responsible for what you brought to the table. Because it's all good to blame one person, but if you put the blame on one, you know, then you're going to eat yourself alive with the guilt and still whatnot. So you have to heal and you have to know your boundaries. You can't just jump from one bad relationship into another and think it's going to be wonderful if you haven't healed. Because what you do is that you start to look for familiarity. And that's why a lot of women get stuck. Oh, that feels familiar. Where you got to make it where we'll know that I'm not doing that again. Let me work on myself so that then I can be healthy and attract a healthy relationship.
That's a beautiful way to end this. Thank you so much for your time. I really do admire you and I love all your work and everything that you do. You're absolutely brilliant and I think that you should absolutely have a seat at the table. So I don't know how we get that happening, but I'll write a letter to the Prime Minister. I mean, he won't read what I have to say, probably not, but, you know, if anyone should be at the table, it should be you've been in this space for decades and I can't speak highly enough of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.